This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Today we'll conclude our discussion of I and Thou by looking at Buber's criticism of many forms of spirituality or mysticism that purport to dissolve the I-thou relation into unity or non-separation, emptiness, and so forth. And the general thrust of his argument is going to be that if we truly believe that what we are is relational or intersubjective or independent, the things that are described by the I, thou, or I, it primary configuration, then anything that takes us out of the relational, even if it seems to be into some kind of mystical unity with God, is really taking us away from reality, not taking us deeper. And they take us, in fact, into peculiar kinds of I-it relations with our own subjective experience in the guise of mysticism. Now, he goes through a number of different versions of this, and the descriptions may seem abstract and sometimes I think are hard to follow. But I hope if we sort of keep that basic idea in mind that we don't want to dissolve fundamental relationality into a spurious kind of unity, then I think we'll see how he treats things that we might, from one perspective, think of as the kind of Zen sicknesses we're warned about in practice, and see what kinds of parallels and differences there are. So I'm going to begin reading on page 83. Same thing happens if we look on absorption or entering into the self, whether by means of the self's deliverance from all being that is conditioned by I, or by its being understood as the one thinking essence, as the essential element in the religious act. By the first way of looking on this act, it's imagined that God enters the being that is freed from I. And that, I think, is a common enough idea that we empty ourselves of self or ego and create a space for God to enter. And that this is being merged in God. By the second, that the being takes its stand directly in itself as though it were the divine one. That sort of seeing above the earth and below the heavens, I alone am, absolute subjectivity. That is, by the first way, in a supreme moment, the saying of thou ceases, for there is no more twofold being. And by the second, the thou does not in truth exist at all, for there is in truth no twofold being. The first way believes in the unification, the second in the identification of the human with the divine. Now, you know, those are both things that are very often recommended to us in the spiritual practice, right? Unification or non-separation, or the identification of the human with the divine. Both assert a state that is beyond I and thou. And that is his ultimate criticism. The first as an ecstasy that one becomes, the second as in the self-observation of the thinking subject, that one that is and that reveals itself. Both abolish relation. The first, as it were, dynamically through the swallowing up of the I by the thou, which is now no longer a thou. And the second, as it were, statically through the self-recognition of the I, which has been freed and become the self as that which alone is. The doctrines of absorption appeal to the great sayings of identification. See, he's saying this is often what passes as religious experience, as mysticism, as if this is what we're all aiming for. He says, the one above all, the Johannine, or the Gospel of John, I and the Father are one. The other, the teaching of Sandila or the Brahmin Hindu, the all-embracing, this is myself in my very heart. The ways these sayings lead are opposite to one another. The first arises in the life of a person of mythical proportions and advances to a doctrine. The second emerges in a doctrine and then only leads to the mythical life of a person. The character of the saying is transformed along these lines. The Christ of Gospel of John, the word that once became flesh, leads to the Christ of Eckhart, perpetually begotten by God in the human soul. The coronation formula for the self in the Upanishad, this is the real, the self, and thou art the self, leads in a shorter space to the Buddhist formula of dethronement. It's not possible to lay hold of a self, and a self appertaining in truth and reality. I will just try to edit down some of his criticism of both those positions. But he says the doctrine of oneness cannot be substantiated if you read impartially, section by section, the gospel, because the gospel really is all about relation. Rather than I am thou and thou art I, the gospel speaks of the Father and the Son. God and man. And these are indissolubly a real pair, two bearers of the primal relation. which from God to man is termed mission and command, from man to God looking and hearing, and between both knowledge and love. This is the relation the Son, through the Father, dwells and works in him, bows down before the greater and prays to him. All modern attempts to interpret this primal reality of dialogue as a relation of the I to the self or the like are futile. They take their place in the abysmal history of distraction of reality. See, he really wants to insist on the primacy of relation, and anything that wants to dissolve that is a pernicious abstraction. But what of mysticism? Does it not inform us how unity without duality is experienced? May we dispute the truth of its account? I know not of a single, but of two kinds of happening in which duality is no longer experienced. These are at times confused in mystical utterance. I too once confused them. The one is the soul becoming a unity. This is something that takes place not between man and God, but in man. Power is concentrated. Everything that tries to divert it is drawn into the orbit of its mastery, its exaltation. This is the decisive moment for man. Without it, he's unfit for the work of the Spirit. With it, he decides in his innermost being if this means a breathing space or the sufficient end of his way. See, he says that one kind of mysticism, of so we might say seeing the absolute, is but a first step. Do we think of it as a breathing space before we go out into the world, into meeting, into relation? Or do we rest there satisfied? This is an admonition we might find in Zen. To encounter the absolute is not yet enlightenment. And the other form of mysticism here, of overcoming dualism. The other happening lies in the unfathomable nature of the relational act itself, in which two, it is imagined, become one. One and one are united. Bareness shines there into bareness. I and thou are absorbed. Humanity, which is just before confronted the Godhead, is merged in it. But when man, illuminated and exhausted, falls back into the cares of earthly affairs, and with knowledge in his heart thinks of the two situations, is he not bound to find that his being is split asunder and one part given to perdition? What does it help my soul that it can be withdrawn anew from this world here into unity when this world itself has of necessity no part in the unity? What does all enjoyment of God profit a life that is rent in two? If that abundantly rich heavenly moment has nothing to do with my poor earthly moment, what then does it have to do with me, who have to still live, and in all serious, still live on earth? All right? So there he talks about the pitfall of an experience of unity with God, or oneness, or emptiness, that inevitably becomes contrasted with our ordinary life of duality on earth. And that what we find, if we think that the real thing is that unity, what does that turn our ordinary life into? It simply becomes something that we're always trying to escape back into this mystical experience. See, that again is a kind of Zen sickness that we might recognize, or at least I'm going to make that analogy. Experiences of oneness that seem to put us in another realm are just experiences, he says. They're not showing us how things really are, but rather they are another kind of it, something that we create and hold on to, but which ultimately turns against us because it makes our ordinary life seem either unreal or unworthy. Let's see. So now he's going to say something about the alternative to this kind of attempt to overcome dualism. Dualism being such a dirty word, right? Now, he, in a sense, he wants to rehabilitate the idea of dualism. In lived reality, there is no unity of being. Reality exists only in effective action. Its power and depth in the power and depth of action. Inner reality exists only if there is mutual action. The most powerful and deepest reality exists where everything enters into the effective action. Without reserve, the whole man and the God all-embracing, the united I and the boundless thou. The united I, for in lived reality, there is the becoming one of the soul, the concentration of power, the decisive moment for a man. But this does not involve, like absorption, disregard of the real person. Absorption wishes to preserve only the pure, the real, the lasting, and to cast away everything else. But in this concentration, the instinctive is not thought too impure. The sensuous is not thought too remote from its course. What is concerned with emotion is not thought too fleeting. Everything must be gathered into the orbit of its mastery. This concentration does not desire the self that is set apart, but the whole unimpaired man. It aims at and is reality. Right? Let me paraphrase that again. Absorption, the pursuit of oneness, wishes to preserve only the pure. But the concentration of the self that he's talking about, of the united I of I, thou, doesn't exclude anything. The instinctive is not excluded. The sensuous is not excluded. The emotion is not excluded. Everything is gathered into the I. The doctrine of absorption demands and promises refuge in the one thinking essence, refuge in pure subject. We encounter this in a number of places, a kind of Advaita practice, which says what we are is pure awareness without content. But in lived reality, there's not something thinking without something thought. Rather, is the thinking no less dependent on the thing thought than the latter on the former? A subject deprived of its object is deprived of its reality. Now, this is very important, and it was also a fundamental tenet of the phenomenology that was being formulated by Husserl at the beginning of the 20th century, a little before Buber's time. He was writing this, that consciousness is always intentional, always has aboutness. It always has object and content. That the idea of pure, contentless awareness is a kind of philosophical or religious myth. And yet it's something we encounter over and over again in lots of different places. But here, Buber is articulating what I think is the correct kind of picture of oneness as interdependence or non-separation from the world of content. We are one with the world, not because we are part of a single homogenized substance, but because we're co-constituted by it. There's nothing inside us that wasn't outside. Whatever we think in the language of the world. Whatever we see or feel exists because of perception and sensory stimulation. There is no inner that is not created by an encounter with the outer. We cannot have an inner without an outer. And Buber here is making a point that I've made and before, that the pursuit of a pure inner, a pure awareness, free of any kind of dependence on an outer world, is a kind of curative fantasy of autonomy and purity that seeks to save us from the vulnerability of actual interdependence. A subject deprived of its object is deprived of its reality. The fantasy of a condition of absorption resembling deep sleep, which is by nature without consciousness and memory, awareness without content. These, he says, are the loftiest peaks of the language of it. This is the creation and reification of inner experience. And I think I'll end just with a little bit of what he says about Buddha here. Buddha describes as the goal the sensation of pain, that is, of becoming and passing away, released from the cycle of births. Henceforth, there is no return, is the formula of the man who's freed himself from the appetite for living and thus from the necessity to become ever anew. We do not know if there is a return. We do not extend beyond this life at the lines of this time dimension in which we live. But we do know that if there is a return, we would not seek to escape it. And we would long not, indeed, for gross being, but for the power to speak. In each existence in its own way and language, the eternal I that passes away and the eternal thou that does not pass away. It's a kind of Nietzschean idea of instead of cessation, an affirmation of eternal return. If there is a return, why would we avoid it? The Buddha knows the saying of the thou to men. Witness his intercourse with his pupils, in which, though high above them, he speaks very directly. But he does not teach it, for simple confrontation of being with being is alien to this love, where all that has become is illimitably comprised in the breast. Well, I'm not sure what that means. He certainly knows, too, in the silence depth of his being, the saying of thou to the primal cause, way beyond all those gods that are treated by him like pupils. This act of his springs from a relational event that is taken on substance. This act, too, is a response to the thou. But about this response, he preserves silence. He ends, though, his succession among the people, that great vehicle, has contradicted him magnificently. It has addressed the eternal human thou under the name of Buddha himself. And it awaits, as the Buddha that is to come, the last of the age, him by whom love is to be fulfilled. I take that to mean that the great irony is that Buddha, despite all his efforts at proclaiming emptiness, himself has become a thou, addressed as God is addressed by successive generations. That almost despite himself, he embodies our relation to the divine. I'm going to stop here. I want to say that for me, the crux of Buber is in the affirmation of relation, and where that relation is between individuals, between individuals and nature, that this is not dissolvable into some unitary essence or being. This, I think, is the deep wisdom of intersubjectivity and interdependence. The thou of the divine, I cannot follow him there. That really, honestly has no meaning to me. In this section, I see all the ways in which we might talk about the perversion or corruption of the mystical, the way in which experiences of unity become it rather than thou, take us out of the world of relation and into the realm of reification of private experience as ultimate reality. These are, I think, very cogent warnings to anybody who practices. There's something in Zen practice that always runs the danger of eliminating the individuality of the other. In talking about non-separation, we are in danger of losing track of empathy with otherness. So Buber's a good corrective to that, I hope. And I hope we can continue to explore that in our discussion and Q&A later. Thank you.